Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and my guest this week will be well known to listeners, partly because she is the co-host of this podcast. I'm joined this week by Olivia Potts, who is, as well as the Spectator's vintage chef columnist, the author of a new book called A Half-Baked Idea, How Grief, Love and Cake Took Me from the Courtroom to Le Cordon Bleu. We thought listeners might enjoy hearing her story, so here she is. Welcome, Livy.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Livy, I've just finished your book and it's brilliant. I'd recommend it to everyone listening. The premise is obviously that your mother died and it sort of set you on this new path. You were a criminal barrister and then you became a professional cook. Let's start at the beginning where we always start, though. What was food like when you were a child?
Food was good when I was a child. My mum was a really good cook. I didn't really have a culinary inheritance from her as such, because although she was a good cook, she didn't really enjoy cooking. So it wasn't something where I stood at her hip in the kitchen and learned how to bake fairy cakes or learned how she makes her stews or anything like that. But she was actually a really proficient cook. She'd learnt to cook when her mother had had a hip operation and had been indisposed. So mum had been cooking from when she was a teenager and was very much of the Delia Smith school of cookery and, you know, had a smallish repertoire of really good dinner party dishes that she would pull out. And, you know, she cooked for me and my sister and my dad every day. So we were very well fed, although I was speaking to my sister recently as I finished up writing the book, and I said, you know, what do you remember of mum's cookery? And I was thinking she'd say, you know, oh, she made the most fantastic shepherd's pie, which I do talk about in the book, or minestrone soup, or she used to make these coq au vins and boeuf bourguignons. You know, she was great. Madeline said, do you remember those pita pizzas she used to make, where she'd buy pre-grated cheddar from Asda and some wafer thin ham and then top it with dried oregano? God, I loved those. And I thought, oh my God, if mum could hear that this is her culinary legacy, wholemeal pita pizzas that we used to have on a Friday night. But you know, those are the things you remember, and the smell of oregano is still, I mean, that's what it brings back to me. It's not memories of perfect Italian cookery, it's the pita pizzas we had.
One of the recipes that you sort of talk about, where I should explain to listeners, your book is part memoir and then also has a mixture of recipes at the end,
yes,
of every chapter.
Yeah, 16 recipes that link into whatever the chapter's been talking about.
And one of the dishes, which actually I don't think you have a recipe for, but you talk about it as one of the kind of key dishes, was this fish pie, which, yeah, you say your mother used to cook and you didn't necessarily like it very much, but then you came back to it later and sort of rediscovered it. I mean,
yeah.
Where did that come
from?
Well,
so fish pie was one of the first things I made when I started cooking. So mum died when I was 25, and having not, as I say, learnt at her hip how to cook, I couldn't. I was living in London, I was a criminal barrister, and I lived off ready meals and supermarket pasta sauces and takeaways and oven pizzas and, you know, a very healthy, balanced diet. I really wasn't cooking for myself, and when mum died, quite quickly one of the ways I coped with the loss was to start cooking, although not really deliberately. It was this very automatic, cathartic thing that I started doing. So I wasn't really putting any thought into it, and I certainly wasn't putting thought into what I was making or what the emotional implications of that might be. And I came home from court one day and was walking around. I lived in Crouch End, and I walked around the Waitrose in Crouch End and found myself, rather than picking up a ready meal, picking up ingredients, which was in itself quite novel. And I picked up milk and cheese and potatoes and one of those a little triple packs of fish that are meant for fish pies. They've got the white fish and the smoked fish and the salmon in it, and they're always reduced, so realistically that was probably the thing that sparked the whole debacle. But I took it home and I started cooking, and I googled a recipe. I could not tell you what that recipe was or where I found it, but I started following a recipe, and I poached the fish in the milk and then used the milk to make the white sauce, and I mashed the potato, and I made this whole fish pie. And it was something, as I say, and as you said, that mum fed us a lot when we were younger. Fish on Fridays, fish pie. And it took me probably until halfway through making it that I realised that I really hated fish pie. Which was not the ideal time to discover that. But then I ate it and realised that actually things can change and you can get quite a lot of comfort and happiness from a dish that is part of your childhood, even if it's one that you thought for a long time was a dish of disgust and unpleasantness.
going back slightly, one of the things that sort of striking about your book was obviously you were in school and then obviously you went to Cambridge and then you became a barrister. So you were sort of in these various institutions. What were you, obviously you know about the ready meals. I mean, what, at Cambridge, what were you eating?
Oh, I mean, I didn't eat terribly well at Cambridge. So my first term, I was so nervous the whole time and really homesick that I didn't really fancy eating most of the time. So I survived on a diet of Bourbon biscuits and Marmite on toast. And that was pretty much all I ate. My college was a really small college that encouraged you to eat in hall. The idea was that you would eat three meals a day in hall. And what that meant was that they didn't provide you with brilliant kitchens in the student accommodation. So I could just about manage toast. I used to poach eggs in a mug in the microwave, which was disgusting. Although I didn't think it was at the time. I thought it was delicious. I thought, you know, I was the next Nigella Lawson. Eaten on, you know, white sliced bread from like the value range at the supermarket, normally with some ketchup. I remember making, it's really unpleasant, I remember making salami and cheese tasties on that same bread in the microwave, which was, well, I mean, it sustained me. And then in hall, when I did, you know, when I finally got over my nerves and my homesickness and I started eating more normally, I just remember a lot of courgettes. The rumour was that Corpus had some kind of courgette farm and it had greater supply than demand because we were so small and courgettes grow like Topsy. So it was just courgettes with every meal. And, you know, it is very, and I say this as a caterer, it is very, very difficult to mass cater courgettes in any kind of palatable way. They do not take well to sitting on a hot plate. They don't last well boiled or whatever and then left sitting. So, yeah, a lot of courgettes. I remember in hall, there was a new chef who was very into, this is when we had formal hall in the evenings rather than just going and eating normally, and there was a chef who was very into ice creams and sorbets. So there were a lot of strangely flavoured, you know, tomato sorbet and Guinness palate cleanser in between courses and that kind of thing. But, I mean, food didn't really form a massive part of my Cambridge education. At that point, there are now brilliant restaurants in Cambridge, but there weren't that many back then. So we would eat, you know, not to do it down, but at Pizza Express or Zizi's or, you know, chain Italian restaurant. Well, exactly. Or Gardi's if you were looking for a late night snack. But it was more really about, obviously, studying very, very hard and also drinking. Those were formed a greater part of my time at Cambridge.
And you don't mention this in the book, perhaps too modest, but I remember when I first got to Cambridge, you were president of the union, which is a very eminent position. I remember that always seemed to involve quite a lot of entertaining because you have the guests up and they'd have dinner. I mean, was that enjoyable part of the job?
Yeah, I mean, a really surreal part of the job. I remember one dinner that I was at when I was senior officer just before I became president, sitting between Edwina Curry and Abby Titmuss. It became a form of currency, someone coming up to me when we had Jermaine Greer as a guest and begging me to move the seating plan around so that she could sit next to what was at that point her feminist icon. So you were, you know, you're just a 20-year-old student who is filled with this sense of their own importance, but actually doesn't know anything. And you're wining and dining these incredibly eminent guests. I remember dealing with dietary requirements for people and having no idea what I was doing. I'd never had to, you know, sort someone else's dietary requirements, and suddenly we had really important people there and you couldn't be messing them around. But a lot of it was socialising, and that was a side of it I really enjoyed. We used to have, I don't know if they still do this, kind of hope not, but we did used to have sherry receptions before the dinner in one of the rooms in the union, and you know, you'd be standing around with all these people drinking. I'd never drunk sherry before. I didn't really know what it was, and of course it was Harvey's Bristol Cream Sherry. We weren't talking like, you know, Manzanilla or Fino, like other podcast guests have discussed. It was the sort of stuff your granny drinks. But that was what we did because we were, as I say, very institutionalised.
After Cambridge, you then moved to London, as you said, and you became a junior barrister or a baby barrister, as you put it in the book. And you describe the diet that you sort of survived on. And there were, I made a note of some of the things, egg McMuffins, lots of coffee, and then you don't actually eat them, but there are these things called breakfast rations that your clients were often given
if they're
in the cells.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you survive on that sort of diet?
I mean, you are mainly, first of all, you're 22, 23, so you are able to survive on less worthy food than, I think, if I were doing it now, I would be a grey mess if I tried to exist as I did then. But really, you're on so much adrenaline most of the time, not just because you are a criminal barrister and you're standing up and representing people, but because everything you're doing is new. You know, you're in a job where literally for the first 2 years, there's something brand new every day that you haven't encountered. So you're living on your nerves, and you are also living from train station to train station, because as a criminal barrister, you tend not to know where you're going the following day unless you're in the middle of a big trial. You go certainly all around the southeast of England, but often around the whole country. You know, I would have cases on the Isle of Wight, and you spend most of your time at, well, ferry terminals or train stations and on buses. So you live on what you can get there, which tends to be better catered now than it was, but even so, a life of sandwiches and coffee, really. And it certainly doesn't instill in you great culinary knowledge or prowess, or often afford you the time for it. I mean, I was lucky as it went on, I did learn to cook, but generally you get home at night and you're prepping a case for the following day and you don't want to sit down and make some kind of elaborate stew.
You also, I mean, you talk also about this tea that some of the barristers would have, and also some of the meals. I mean, was there also quite a sort of sociable aspect to it?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on which set of chambers you're in. I was very lucky to be in a very friendly and social set of chambers. So the way chambers tea normally works is that you are in a commercial set of chambers and you spend almost all your day in the office writing expert opinions on various areas of law. And then about 3 p.m, you all gather together and drink tea and eat cake and talk about the cases you're doing and exchange advice and anecdotes and gossip. Doesn't really happen in criminal chambers because people are so all over the place. You know, they are more likely to be in court and probably a far-flung court. But we had a particular member of chambers who was adamant we were going to do this, and he put in all the time and effort. So there were always a dozen different types of fancy teas in our big room in chambers, which was the room that I sat in, and he would provide cakes and biscuits and people would wander in and Alan would make tea. And it was one of the happiest parts of my time in chambers, being able to talk to more experienced barristers about the cases they were doing, but also just a source of friendship and a moment to relax a bit. And I think it is unusual in criminal chambers, and I'm very, very glad it was a part of mine.
Your mother died in 2013, obviously whilst you were working as a barrister, yeah. And just before your tenancy decision, and you were then offered tenancy, and your book is about why you decided to change from clearly a glistening career in the world of criminal law to training at the Cordon Bleu. Did you feel that grief sort of changed your appetite both for food and for life?
Yeah, I think so. I was offered tenancy probably 3 months after Mum died, and I accepted it, and I then worked as a criminal barrister for a subsequent, I think, 3 years, 2.5 years, something like that. So I did have a career after that. But I do think that death of a loved one changes you. And I was quite resistant at the time. When I started thinking about leaving the bar, I was very unhappy. I was very anxious. I found the daily reality of doing the cases and bearing the responsibility of these clients' lives and futures really, really difficult. And I felt like I would get home at night and I couldn't free myself of those panics, which is a really unhealthy way to live as a barrister. You have to be able to detach slightly at some points in order to live your own life. But I was very resistant to the idea that this was caused by my mum's death and that it wasn't an organic change of heart or decision that came about. I mean, looking back, obviously, my priorities and my attitudes towards life and work changed after Mum died. And I think, looking back on it now, that resistance was just another part of the grieving process, that I didn't want to be accused, and I wasn't really. I mean, there's a small set piece in the book, but I didn't want to be accused of being capricious in my decision, of it being ill thought out, or it simply being an immediate reaction to something that happened to me. I wanted people to take me seriously, even as I left the bar. I think that's probably where the resistance came from. But, and this is a cliche, you do realise that life is often brutally short. And I really decided that it was clear to everyone around me that being a barrister was making me actively unhappy, and I wanted to try and be happy. So in that sense, certainly it was Mum's death that pushed that forward.
And whilst you're working as a barrister, you're sort of teaching yourself to cook, kind of self-taught. But what was it that was so enticing about learning to cook in such a formal environment?
So the bits of cooking that appealed to me from an early stage were already the most formalised bits. So what I really developed a passion for was baking. And baking is the most structured area, particularly, you know, the patisserie side of it, which is what I ended up studying at Le Cordon Bleu, is all about following recipes really closely. And I think it was a couple of different things for me. I think I leaned towards recipes rather than that style of sort of instinctive ad hoc cooking, which now I enjoy a lot and I'm much better at, but at the time seemed like an alien world. I was much more interested in leaning towards recipes because I hadn't learnt at a younger age. I didn't have that instinct. It was so beyond me that I wanted somebody to tell me how things were going to work. And baking does that to a far more formalised extent. You know, when you get to a high level, you're weighing salt to the gram and you're weighing water for bread rather than measuring it in a measuring jug. Like, it's very, very structured and strict. And I liked that because I didn't understand not using recipes. But then also, from a more emotional, holistic side of it, it was providing me with some kind of structure where suddenly I'd lost all structure. I was planning to leave my job that I thought when I went into it I was going to do for the rest of my life. I'd lost my mum, who, and I, you know, sounds trite, but was my best friend and was also the person that I spoke to more than anyone. So I had a lot of time on my hands all of a sudden. And I didn't know what I was doing. And I liked that you would take a cake recipe, take the ingredients it tells you to use, put it into the oven, and it would produce a cake. It was as simple as that, there was this formalised route to producing something, and if I followed the rules, I'd win. And I loved that. And as time went on, you know, I became much more interested in patisserie as a technique and a school of cooking. But in the early days, I just wanted to follow something that would work.
I mean, your book is fascinating because you have your time in the criminal bar and then you have the Cordon Bleu. And I found the bit about the Cordon Bleu so interesting because you sort of provide this insight into this institution that people perhaps don't know about. Yeah. And what I found particularly interesting was that it seems actually so kind of old-fashioned. Like, a lot of the dishes you're making are Black Forest gâteau and you're carving plums into swans and blowing...
That was beyond my skill level, but some people
blowing sugar apples. I mean, why did you decide to go for that course? Did you enjoy the fact that it was quite old-fashioned?
Yeah, I mean, I joke about being institutionalised, but I really do love learning in a sense where I'm being actively taught. That is how I learn best. So before I went to Cordon Bleu, when I was teaching myself, I was learning, and I was learning mostly as you know, as people do. It was then 2014, but as people do in 2019, I was learning from the internet and a bit from cookery books, and I was reading a lot. But I was feeling frustrated in that if something went wrong, I couldn't necessarily work out why it had gone wrong. And I couldn't sort of cross-pollinate my skills. So I could do certain things if I was following a very explicit recipe, but then I didn't understand why gelatin might not work with kiwi fruit, for example, whereas now I know it's because of the acids in kiwi fruit, you just can't, or pineapple, you can't set pineapple and kiwi jelly. But at the time, it was just all this sort of amorphous blur around me. I would make a recipe, I would follow it, and then that would be it. And that initially was extremely appealing, as I say, but began to become quite frustrating. And I realised that what I wanted to do was I wanted to learn a lot, and I wanted to learn fast, and I wanted to be actively taught it. So that was why I decided I wanted to go to culinary school and do the full-time course. And then I quite like old-fashioned things, you know, as you've said, I went to Cambridge, I was president of the union, I went to the bar, I write for The Spectator. Like,
I'm
the vintage chef. I like tradition. And I like the fact that it was going to take me, the course takes you from day one fruit salad to the final exam, which is 6 hours, no breaks, and you are producing a really, really impressive dish that you have invented but sticks to certain rubric that they have required. So it really is taking you from not being able to do anything at all to producing something which is professional and restaurant standard. And I like that. I like the fact that it was sort of all-inclusive. And I get to the end and be able to do everything and have tried my hand at everything and be around some of the best chefs that I could imagine teaching me how to do it and telling me why things were wrong and when things were wrong.
You also described some of the people who are on the course with you, and they range from 18-year-olds who have a day instead of university. There's a mother who wants to cook
for her family. Yeah. And she wasn't doing the 9-month course, to be fair. She was doing 3 months. She wasn't thinking of blowing sugar apples for her husband.
Even so.
I mean, she could do, I'm sure.
But did you sort of know what you wanted to do with it?
No. Well, yes, I thought I did, actually. So I'd started writing for The Spectator and a couple of other places about food before I went to Le Cordon Bleu, although it was sort of in my mind that this was maybe a thing I wanted to do, and I knew that in some way I had to leave the bar. You'd very kindly given me a column, which made me feel less like a fraud, a little bit. Still felt like a bit of a fraud. I thought what I wanted to do was solely food writing, and this was part of the rationale for going and doing this comprehensive 9-month course, because I thought it would give me the bones to become an expert in making puddings and patisserie, and that I would then be able to write about them from an informed point of view, but also the point of view of someone who hadn't grown up through a restaurant. I'd started at this point of total ignorance and then learned. I thought that'd be great. Might write a book. Definitely didn't think I was going to write this book. But it wasn't until I was probably about halfway through Cordon Bleu that I even considered cooking professionally. So I talk in the book about the fact that I have fibromyalgia, which means that I get tired very easily, and I have strength and mobility problems. So I really wasn't going to Le Cordon Bleu, like many people do, thinking I will exit this as a patisserie chef in a Michelin-starred kitchen. That was never on the cards, because I knew that physically I wasn't capable of that. And I didn't really want to do it anyway, only in the sense that I don't like not being able to do things. But there was no other real desire there. But I made a friend outside of Cordon Bleu whilst I was studying there called Kate Young, who is a food writer herself, and at the time was leaving her career in theatre to go and try and make it in the food writing world. And she and I just became friends and would cook in the kitchen in the house she was living at the time. We would bake together, and it made us really happy. But it took me a long time to think of that as anything more than a friendship that was based around food. And then someone suggested we cater a supper club together. And we thought, well, we can cook for 4 people. We can probably cook for 16. We tried it. It was really hard. It does not work like that. It's much, much harder, particularly when you've charged people for tickets. And then halfway through, you think, God, I wish I'd made this free. But we survived, and people were very kind about it. And we kept going with the supper clubs. And then someone said, could you do a wedding? And we thought, no. And we said, yes, because we're idiots. And we catered our first wedding. And again, it was really, really hard, but it was also really fulfilling. And I found that I'd discovered this kitchen that I could be in with someone whose cooking I loved and whose companionship I loved. And it brought the real happiness that I think I've been searching for the whole time. So we started up a little company, and now we cater weddings. But when I went to Cordon Bleu, I didn't think I would ever cook professionally. That was a surprise that came out of it.
And I wanted to ask you about your food writing, because, I mean, obviously you have written this book, but you don't really actually talk about it a huge amount in the book.
No.
And I knew that you wrote about food because you had this blog, which you originally started. Who do you love to read writing about food?
I mean, I love reading about food. I will read anything. So not just my sort of food memoir or grief food memoir is its own subgenre. I don't just read that. So I love reading what I think of as proper cookery writing. So I love reading the old stuff. I love reading Elizabeth David and Jane Grigson and M.F.K. Fisher. But then I love the modern stuff. I love Diana Henry's cookbooks. You could read like a novel in bed. Tom Eagle writes so beautifully about food. Rachel Roddy writes beautifully about food and about cookery and about the connections that we have as people to the food we are making and eating. I like reading investigative work on food. Bea Wilson is particularly good on that. But I like reading, never say never, but I would never do restaurant criticism, but I love reading that kind of food. So I love reading Anthony Bourdain and Ruth Reichel. I think the only way you become a good writer is by reading as widely and as well as you can. You can't be a good writer unless you're a good reader. And I think, that's a very good reason to read food writing, but it's also a good reason to read all kinds of writing. And so often, both non-fiction and fiction writers who don't specialise in food will have incredible descriptions of food in them. So, like Elizabeth Jane Howard writes beautifully about food. Amy Tan, the food in her novels are so connected, and Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, so connected to the culture and the community and the plot. So I will read any food writing whatsoever. But those are a few of my favourites.
And what about your recipes for Spectator Life? So obviously you have your column, which is on Spectator Life, anyone hasn't come across it yet. How do you come up with the dishes?
So when we first devised the column a long time ago, we went with this idea of vintage dishes. So initially, I was looking to, I think, rehabilitate certain dishes. So some of the earliest ones are dishes that we see a bit less of now in restaurants and at home, but still have, and perhaps have bad associations with them, but still have the potential to be fantastic. So the very first recipe I ever did for you was blancmange. And I confess that when I first started developing the recipe and workshopping it, I ate a lot of very bad blancmanges. But through working it and reading it, I discovered that actually, I mean, it's basically a panna cotta. So it's a delicious dish. It's, you know, cream and flavourings and sugar set with gelatin. It's fantastic. And I did the same with rice pudding and steak and kidney pudding. And it went from there. I mean, I think I've probably not exhausted, but used up a lot of the really hateful dishes. I mean, I still have to tackle tapioca, but many of them are in the archives of Vintage Chef. And now I just like looking for kitsch dishes, I think. Ones that whilst perhaps not actively unpopular, are perhaps a little bit out of favour with our current dining. So I'm doing, what am I doing? So I'm doing eel flottante this week, which I'm really looking forward to doing. The puddings, as will be clear to anyone who reads my columns, puddings are my wheelhouse, puddings are my favourite. And I think people have such strong connections to sweet dishes in a way that they perhaps don't so much with the savoury. So, and I try and fit it to the seasons, you know, summer pudding recently. I'm not going to be doing that in November. But really, it's trawling old cookbooks and finding things, hopefully in really dated photos that look completely ridiculous from the time, and then giving them a facelift and making them totally delicious.
And finally, I mean, you know this question well, because we often ask it on this podcast, but if you had to pick your final meal out of everything, what would you go for?
Oh, obviously there are so many things to choose from. I think, as someone who writes about emotional connections with food, it would probably be my husband's club sandwiches. And they are not the best club sandwiches in the world. I'm sorry, Sam. They change every single time he makes them. But they're always really great, and
What goes into them?
Oh, God, whatever's reduced in the supermarket. And they could be on any type of bread. It doesn't really matter. But he makes them with such care. And he knows how much I love them. And also, it's a real treat. I love cooking, but it's a real treat to sit on the sofa and have someone bring you a really good sandwich. And I think it's hard to beat a really cracking sandwich. So for me, it would be his club sandwiches. And if he wasn't listening, probably my sausage pasta.
And for pudding?
Pudding would be something really traditional but well made, probably a crumble, maybe a rice pudding, made by me. Recipes available online, with seasonal fruit and lots of custard.
Delicious. Livy, thank you so much joining our podcast. And Livy's book, A Half-Baked Idea, is now available in all good bookshops.